Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism, coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Peter Frey and I'm the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at the University of Technology Sydney, and my producers today are Anthony Dockrell and Julia Carr-Katzel. So while we've all been digesting the federal election and its aftermath, and wondering why News Limited is opening up a new site in Canberra, and how much Sky News' David Spears is going to be paid to defect to the ABC, the world has been busy spinning. There's been elections in South Africa, in Indonesia, in Israel, India, and the European Union. Trump's been playing golf in Japan. Theresa May will soon be out of a job. And Julian Assange has been hit with espionage charges in the United States. So there's been a lot going on, but how has it been reported? Tonight we ask some hard questions about how we get our international news and how the world views us, and yes, what we might think about May's demise and Julian Assange. Yes, it's big stuff, and to tackle those big issues, we've recruited a suitably big in name and in reputation panel. Returning to the Fourth Estate, we have Jamie Smith, who is the Australian Pacific correspondent for the Financial Times. Hello, Jamie.
Hello, good afternoon.
Nice to see you again. Jonathan Perlman, who is the editor of Australian Foreign Affairs and the world editor of the Saturday Paper. Hello, Jonathan.
Hi, Peter.
And also, I might add, a former London Daily Telegraph stringer, among many other jobs you've had. Great
That's
to see.
Right. Thanks.
And Chrysanthidiotis. Did I say that right?
No.
No, I never say it right, do I? Who is a journalist. She's reported from some very far-flung places, including the Democratic Republic of Congo, and an academic who is a postdoc research fellow at the Centre for Media Transition. So it's a little bit in-house tonight, but she specializes in what's called localism, and more about that in a minute. Hello, Chrysanthi.
Hi, Peter.
And now you need to please say your name for us.
Chrysanthi Giotis.
Giotis.
Yeah.
Giotis.
Or Yotis, if you want to say
Yotis.
It in Greek.
Okay, thank you. Yotis, like the Yotis parked over there. Like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, no, I'll never get it wrong again then. Okay. So let me open with that never-ending car wreck that is Brexit. It's just claimed its second prime minister, with Theresa May resigning after a plan for Brexit was rejected for what seems like, I don't know, the 1,200th time. I know. For all of us who've lost the strength to follow Brexit, can you briefly explain why she's gone now? And just briefly, in a sentence.
I think she's gone because she failed to deliver Brexit, and also because it became clear that she's become a big liability for the party. So this came, her departure is coming against the backdrop of the European elections, where the Conservative Party have been annihilated by Nigel Farage's Brexit Party. So I think that combination of really disappointing the Conservative base in terms of not delivering Brexit, and also the fact that electorally they've suffered a massive defeat, meant her position was untenable.
Okay. I mean, she was always going to go. It just happened to be that day, really, didn't it? Let's talk about how the media covered her departure and how the media has covered her. As it's, I mean, anyone looking at this from afar, you look at it and go, oh, my God, that's remarkable. What a terrible period. I mean, watching someone being essentially put to the rack, really, on a daily basis. Anyway, has she, let's say, like Julia Gillard before her, been given an extra special treatment by the news media because of her gender? What do you think about that, Jonathan?
I don't know how much gender played a part. Mm. I think it's comparable in trying to discern the media's role, it's a little bit comparable to the Trump phenomenon. Brexit and Trump are often compared. Mm. And, you know, these sort of great disruptions. Mm-hmm. The media has been rabid against May.
The media in the UK.
In the media in the UK. Yeah. And it was rabid in the lead up to Brexit. It certainly played a role.
The gender part. I mean, just to you, Chrysanthi, The Sun referred to her as kitten heels in one headline. Famously read, kitten heels must put foot down on immigration now. I mean, those immigration now, sorry. Those sorts of things, Did she get the kind of Gillard treatment, which Gillard famously said it wasn't, you know, it was something, it wasn't all of it. But.
Yeah, I actually am going to come down on the same side as Gillard on this. Gender is always a part of it. Doesn't matter. I mean, we live in a patriarchy. It doesn't matter what you do as a woman. Gender is always a part of it. That's just the way that it is. I expect nothing less from the son, basically. Mm-hmm. And
well, it's kind of their job, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of their job in the way they sort of point out what a patriarchal society we still live in. I actually, from my point of view, the bigger issue is the fact that we're still reporting the man, not the issue.
Yes.
You know, Jonathan just
reporting what she wore and not the issue.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And gender just heightens that. But it is a problem in politics in general. Like, we're not actually reporting the big thing, which is that Brexit has stalled every type of politics in the UK for the last 3 years. There was a fantastic letter to the editor, which was in The Independent today, which was from the Labour students, Young Greens, Scottish Young Greens, Young Liberals, Young Conservatives and Plaid Youth. And they're all coming together to say that we're sick of this.
Can we get on with, you know, something else?
Yeah.
With our lives?
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough.
And I think, Peter, that, I mean, the media have played an extraordinarily divisive role in the UK in the Brexit debate, focusing on personalities, focusing on, it's become a very jingoistic sort of debate there, you know, us against the Europeans, particularly the tabloids. And what that has really meant is you've got very little focus on the complexities of what Brexit actually means. This was a factor in the referendum as well. There really wasn't enough focus on actually what would leaving the EU actually cost Britain. And there wasn't enough focus on, you know, the benefits of Britain being in the EU. But this has a very long history in the UK. You know, over the last 20 to 30 years, there's been extremely biased reporting of Europe. The Murdoch phenomenon there.
Not just Murdoch, though, is it? I mean, the Daily Mail has hardly been a grand supporter of the EU project.
You're dead right. And the Daily Telegraph as well have been very critical. However, it's very interesting. The Daily Mail have shifted sides. More recently, under a new editor, maybe because they've seen the difficulties that this has really brought the country to. But I think, you know, this is a classic example of how journalism is failing in the modern era to get to grips with complexities. It's probably part of society moving on at a very fast rate with social media. There's not a lot of time for people to read context. Maybe they're too busy in their jobs. But, you know, there's a deep failing, I think, in journalism.
Well, that's true. I mean, so I guess with all these sorts of issues, it's whether the news media is reflecting, if you like. I mean, look, let's face it. Brexit is a very complex issue, right? So how do you create demand? I mean, what's the push-pull factors here? How do you create demand to read something about the complexity rather than the fact that Mrs. May wears leopard skin, you know, shoes? I mean, I'm not excusing the media. I'm just saying, how do we go about making things like Brexit better understood? Chrysanthia and then Jonathan.
Well, I think the first thing that we have to do is not blame the audience. I mean, that jingoistic reporting actually, and the jingoistic issues actually point to the fact that the underlying problems which have led to that reporting is a globalized economy and people movements that are the biggest in history, right? Every 2 seconds a person is displaced. Think about that. Another one.
Oh, that's going to make a really difficult program, isn't it? So, turn the program off now. Stop people being displaced.
No, but the point is that actually those are really difficult things to report, and they've come in this time when that is all that social media reporting, which Jamie was just talking about.
So you were blaming the journalists, not the audience?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that we can create the demand.
Okay, we can create the event. This is called the anti-Fourth Estate show today. Jonathan, what do you think? What do you think of the coverage we're getting in this country of Brexit, for instance?
That's a good question. The coverage of...
I mean, is it kind of excusable that we would play, as it were, the sort of personal tragedy, which is quite Shakespearean, it has to be said, of Mrs. May, as opposed to trying to even think about whether it means anything for British or European citizens?
Yeah, I mean, I think now Australia sort of shares the rest of the world's Brexit fatigue, and I think you know, there's probably less reporting of the intricacies than there should be, but that's kind of understandable. I think I don't see a major problem with the reporting of it here, certainly not compared with the reporting that's gone on in Britain. I mean, I don't think we can now get to the bottom of, you know, is the media in Britain following or setting the agenda? But I do think that, you know, some of the issues that Chrysanthi was talking about, you know, people flows and just general kinds of parochialism in Britain, certainly when you're talking about sort of Daily Mail type approach to this issue, that, you know, you can see politicians and the media seizing on kind of emotive responses to that. And when you start to see that happen, I think you start to detect an agenda detect, you know, the media not necessarily merely kind of reflecting views but trying to shape them and manipulate them.
So, Jamie, I'm going to exclude the Financial Times because I'm not going to ask you to talk about your own fine organ. But how do you think the media, the issue was reported? And also this point that came out in a bit of a Reuters Institute study, which was, in essence, that by turning it all into a kind of he said, she said bun fight, it becomes more remote from the average reader. That it actually becomes a kind of more of an abstract concept. Oh, there's a fight happening on in Westminster or Brussels, wherever. And so it's less, even less and less attached to me, my life. And then, you know, so people kind of get disenchanted, disinterested, and before you know it, they're voting Nigel Farage's sort of, you know, into the European Parliament. I don't know. Is this where journalism needs to kind of get real? You know, is it getting too easily distracted by the fluff?
Well, just on the Australian coverage, I'd say one issue there is syndication.
You know? Okay. Yeah,
there's a lot of syndicated copy coming from right-wing newspapers in the UK being published for an Australian audience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's not ideal. So you definitely want to have your own correspondents there on the ground reporting from an Australian point of view. On the he says, she says argument, yeah, that's a big problem, I think, you know. You get this in the issue of climate change coverage as well, where you get this sort of false bias that journalists think they have to report two sides of the same story from a he says, she says. I would think that at one point in that Reuters Institute report that was written after the referendum was they looked at who did people actually cite in the articles. Politicians were cited a lot from both sides. And of course, they're going to have the he says, she says argument. Sure. Who wasn't published a lot of was academics, experts in different fields. Actually, there was a minority and not a lot of people were actually quoted in that. And I think that's where you've really, as a journalist, got a responsibility to try and get outside the political biases, shall we say, you know, the two sides. Try and, you know, you're obviously coming from your own perspective as well, and everyone brings their own bias to it, but try and pick up, you know, experts' analysis from different areas and bring it together yourself
Chrysanthi, on that, I mean, yes, that referendum really was the anti-expert referendum as well, was it? Famously, Michael Gove said, you know, we would trust an expert anymore. Do you think that's a watershed? I mean, are we reached that point in this country, for instance, where we don't really listen to experts or academics, dare I say it?
Oh, gosh. That was a question where I was just supposed to answer yes. That's correct.
Well, no, you can answer no. I don't mind.
I think that in general, there's never been a tendency in Australia to listen to academics. That's pretty well established. Mm. And I don't necessarily think that that's a bad thing. I think that we should be listening just as much to what people are saying in the street as academics, and probably if we did, we wouldn't have got, you know, we wouldn't have relied so much on the polls, and so many journos wouldn't have got the latest election results.
Well, this is your field of study. I mean, we should introduce this now. Glocalism. Tell us about that.
So basically, what my thesis is that we live in a disintermediated world, and there are a lot of people who are getting their news not from the ABC, not even from SBS,
not from
Channel
2. SER.
Not even from 2SER, no, believe it or not, which is a tragedy.
Incredible.
We are getting our news direct from overseas, and at the same time we are actually contributing to a global public sphere. So what we are saying here in Australia is actually reverberating around the world, sometimes more obviously than others. So we actually need to start thinking about the world as a global public sphere. And when we're reporting on things that are happening in the world, that has to be part of it. We need to be connecting with local communities here who are international. Local communities are international and they have their own expertise and they have their own experiences, which most middle-class journalists don't have.
Mm.
And
so your idea is that you'd go out into, say, Jamie here, mm-hmm. example, Exhibit A, would go out and if we were reporting on, say, the re-election and around Ramodi, would go off and talk to the Indian community.
Absolutely.
And what would and why would he do that?
Well, mainly to actually see what they're reading, to hear what discourses okay. they're coming to. So my Indian friends now don't read the BBC or turn to the ABC because they can go direct to the source.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting their news from recommendations on Facebook. And so when that happens, what they're seeing is that they're getting stories about why the election has happened, not just the fact, oh, there's a surge to the right.
Mm.
Okay. So and okay. that sort of that's complexity is not coming through.
Jamie, would you have time to go and talk to the local Indians like that?
Would you believe I did?
Oh, my God. No,
for the Modi election.
This is like a
setup. However, what it was a group of Modi supporters who right. were having a demonstration outside the Sydney Opera House
oh,
to
yeah.
put on Facebook, the social media, to send across the electronic medium to try and boost his support at home. It's quite interesting.
Ooh.
But yeah, I was just tapping that into our global coverage of the Indian election. It was how the diaspora is important in that.
Mm.
But I do see it's important to speak to communities on the ground, and the recent election in Australia shows not many picked up the big swing in Queensland. But it is difficult to do that. It's difficult to, you know, you can go to pubs, you can go to churches, but how many people can you speak to actually get the real feel for what's going on? You know, you can be limited as a journalist with time and resources.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, because you end up, it's kind of like a sampling exercise. Mm. But you're talking about something a little bit different, which is not so much that you would quote these people, rather as you would understand deeper, get a deeper understanding of what was important
yeah,
by
exactly.
talking to these people
yeah,
rather
exactly.
than quoting them. They're not sources.
No, they're not. You ask them to comment on the media coverage.
Yeah, okay.
So you actually get them to be your critics, basically. And so that way in the old days, that would naturally happen, right? You would naturally spend time in long conversations with people, not for quoting, right? Deep background.
Yeah, maybe.
Just doesn't exist.
I mean, I'm old. I don't remember doing that. Maybe. Yes,
I've
okay.
I've heard.
You heard
in
this,
folklore.
This tale. Oh, right,
I've heard
okay.
this tale.
If,
yeah.
if I could add one thing about yeah. journalism and reporting and the lack of expertise, I think one thing, the climate and energy debate in Australia tends to be written by political correspondents, not energy correspondents. And that's a big change in the media that you've seen in the last 20 years because we don't have the personnel and resources.
Yep.
And a lot of it turns to the he says, she says.
Oh, that's right. And Jonathan, you've written a bit about this and you and I have talked about this. Just sticking on Asia for a second, you know, you run a fabulous new magazine journal. I mean, it's a kind of magazine journal.
I'll call it a magazine, but yeah, Jagazine.
It's a Jagazine. Whatever it is, it's fabulous. And you sort of look at those issues around, under the radar. How do you think, I mean, it's sort of like 25 years since Keating told us we were all Asians and no one believed him then, and I think they believe him less now. How do you think we've gone with this Asian thing, Australians? And how do you think Asia's reported here? Broadly, a big question, I know.
I think there are big problems with the way that Asia is reported here. The coverage is fairly shallow and probably shallower than it used to be. You know, and this is another symptom, I suppose, of just foreign bureaus closing down. But Australia over the years has produced some, you know, some great experts out of its media outlets from people who've travelled across Southeast Asia, you know, picked up a lot and then really given a lot back to the debate here.
Mm. They're probably having those deep conversations that Chrysanthi's talking
right.
about in tea houses
that's
and
right.
pubs.
So I think, we're just not going to see that anymore, which I think is really unfortunate. Mm. You know, we've just seen the Indonesian election. It's quite incredible. It's an incredible country. It's incredible what's happened there, the changes that go on there. Mm. And yet coverage here is very limited. It's either limited to, you know, diplomatic disputes, you know, drug smugglers, you know.
Yeah, refugees.
Refugees. Yeah. There's not a lot of in-depth coverage of Indonesian politics, and yet Indonesia is a crucial country to Australia and becoming more and more important as the region changes, as China grows. Indonesia, you know, could potentially be some sort of partner for Australia as China grows.
We should go out there and do more reporting. I do believe that the Judith Nielsen Institute is going to fund or part fund a journalist up there for one of the major news organisations. So
it's
good to see them recognising that. Let's switch a little bit here and talk about how one of my favourite subjects is how Australia's reported to the rest of the world. You both, in fact, you three, have all got some thoughts of this about this. But let's start with you, Jamie. Now, you're a slightly different beast because you report, you know, serious things like oil and gas and politics and what have you. But how do you feel that Australia's sort of, when you're thinking about picking a story, because there's an endless number of stories, right? You know, what guides you? And do you ever find yourself taking your thought process and going, yeah, I really wish I could do that thing about crocodiles and snakes?
Well, my editor, when I got this job, he said, do not report on sharks.
Really?
No shark stories.
No sharks.
No animal attack stories. You're there to be a serious journalist. Well, and part of the FT mantra.
What a person.
Now, however, shark stories go down extremely well with the public. And I did write a shark story. More about the technology of sharks.
Really? Yeah. Is that thing about spotting them using AI and
drones and shark resistance suits.
Yeah, okay.
I just wanted to get out there with those.
You did, didn't you?
Those
amazing
animals.
Couldn't resist it.
Yes. However, I mean, for us, the way we cover Australia is very much, we are a global newspaper. We're looking at how Australia fits into its region and the world.
Okay.
So I'm trying to tap into global themes. So, for example, you know, some of the best themes here have been climate change, Great Barrier Reef, how 50% of the corals died. That's a fascinating story. And it's, you know, obviously got consequences for reef systems around the world. The energy transition is really interesting. Australia's, you know, really quite an amazing country in terms of renewables, and it's doing some pretty dynamic stuff, even though most of what you see in the domestic press is stuff about coal. But there's great stories there. And the rise of China has been another big theme for us. And we like to tell that story through Australian eyes, you know, the amount of investment that's come in here, the foreign influence debate. There's a multiplicity of great global themes that we can tap into. And occasionally I do look for an animal story, but it has to fit.
I'm going to go to Chrysanthemum in a second, but first you, Jonathan, because A, you've got this new wonderful magazine. Well, not so new now, it's a year old, right?
A little bit more than a year.
Yeah. But when you were the London Daily Telegraph person, so
that's a very serious
newspaper too, of course, a bit like the FT, but you would have done your fair share of dingoes and snakes.
That's
and
a huge
spiders
understatement. I didn't get that.
You didn't get that.
I didn't get the opposite mantra from my editors because they weren't that explicit, but they loved anything to do with sharks, koalas, racist Brits, racist Australians.
All that the was stereotypes.
They loved it. And I have to say, I mean, that was just the way the Telegraph does see Australia. It's interested in Australia as a colour story, and it's not interested in it as in any great political depth in terms of elections.
Is that because a lot of its readers own it, so they don't need to worry about what's going on?
Quite possibly.
So they read the FT to work out what's happening to that, and their children can read their stories about dingoes eating their babies.
I think the FT is closer to a paper of record, and the Telegraph doesn't see itself like that.
You're no longer the Daily Telegraph stringer.
I'm not. Yeah. So I can talk.
If they ever hear this, you will never be the DT stringer again.
That's true. You know, I think the Telegraph's world coverage is fantastic. I think they take they can really bring readers into stories, and you know, it's just, I'm talking particularly about the way they see Australia, but but the Telegraph does take world coverage.
No, I know.
Seriously.
No, I'll be a bit facetious.
I will say that one thing that I've found interesting is how little the global media have paid attention to Australia as being on the front line of the impacts of China's rise. And it was interesting to see the New York Times just ran a very, very in-depth, really excellent piece on that. It's a piece that could have been written any time over the last sort of 10 years, and now they have a bureau here, so they're investigating this in more depth. But Australia is, I know, you know, we have constant discussion here and debate here about China, and it might seem that it's sort of overkill. But the debate here is occurring at a kind of level and depth that I think is greater than a lot of other countries because of Australia's peculiar situation. Australia is more heavily dependent on China for trade than any other advanced economy that, you know, this just kind of keeps growing.
We're caught in the middle, aren't we?
We're caught in the middle. And so we're a fascinating case study for that. And I think the foreign media should be paying a lot more attention to Australia for that, because there's a lot of great stories coming out here. There's a lot of kind of, you know, fascinating debate, the foreign influence debate, questions about, you know, Chinese spies in Australian universities. I mean, these issues are now playing out abroad, but Australia is just an excellent country to explore that. Yeah, it's a crucial issue.
As Jamie's point, that there's all these global themes that play out here. Krisanthi, there's two things I'd like to ask. I'd like to ask you that question, but also flip it again and talk about the stories that are underreported. For instance, you know, you went to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where what's the body count now? 6 million or more people have died.
Yeah, so that's a disputed figure, but yes, yeah. 6 million.
Okay,
is the body
millions
count.
Of people have
millions
died,
of people,
and
absolutely.
Probably one of the least reported stories on the planet.
Yeah, I mean, if I can just quickly comment on that last discussion, what I loved about that was actually just hearing that it just brought to the fore why foreign correspondence is still so necessary, because it shines a light on our own society by seeing how we are reported by others, and that's one of the beauties of the age that we live in now. Mm. Reading FT stories about Australia, tapping into those global stories, that's exactly what we should be doing. That's exactly what foreign correspondents should be doing. Unfortunately, those links aren't often made. So, for example, I still own an iPhone, even though I know that it's quite possible that there are minerals in my iPhone that are contributing to that huge body
count. You're
not
alone in owning an iPhone, I just might add that.
No, yeah. But still, like, I find it completely hypocritical that I go and report on the refugee situation or displaced person situation in the Congo and still own an iPhone. But, you know, the answers aren't there. And I think the fact that those answers are so difficult is why you have statistics like the fact that, you know, so on the same day, this is a statistic I love from philosopher Alain de Botton in his book on the news. So on the same day that the BBC recorded 2.52 million readers for Bowie Comeback Makes Top 10 Singles Chart, there was a story, East DR Congo Faces Catastrophic Humanitarian Crisis, and you get 4,450 readers.
Wow.
But I don't blame the audience for that. Like, we don't know what to do, you know? And because we're not getting those complex stories, because we're not making these links, you know, the audience knows what they're going to read. They're going to read death and destruction.
It kind of goes a little bit to the what is journalism about as well, right? I mean, so one of the roles of journalists, I mean, is to entertain. I suppose 2.5 million people were interested in Bowie. I'm a very popular singer and all that, and they don't necessarily want to read about millions dying in the DRC. I know.
But I think that they
again,
would.
Again, let's not blame the audience.
But I think that they would if we actually knew what was going on in the DRC more generally.
I don't disagree with you.
Jonathan? Yeah, I was going to mention, I think there's one interesting dynamic. I mean, I think, you know, racism plays a big part in our attitudes here in the DRC. Yeah, and seen as, you know, poor and irrelevant. So I think that plays a part. It's also a hard country to report on. I went there years ago with the great photographer Kate Geraghty when we were at Sydney Morning Herald. We had to pay our own way, and the Sydney Morning Herald didn't want us to go because it was worried about.
Was I added
consequences?
To that?
Quite possibly. Oh, no. You ran our stories.
Oh, that's right.
Thanks.
Yeah, good pieces.
I think one of the dangers is we've just got an app or a program that all the journalists have got called Lantern, which shows the metrics of how many clicks on your stories. And the editors read that assiduously in the FT. And of course, you know, if your story gets under 5,000 clicks,
Don't do it again.
we don't want to do it again. So I'll give you a classic example, the Manus Island Nauru stories. You know, that is a really important journalistic story which says a lot about Australia. It's not very popular with our readers, so we probably haven't written as much about it, certainly in the last year or two, than I would be particularly happy with. So it's these types of issues.
Right. I mean, but this does go to that rather complex question. So the audience is making that decision for you then, isn't it?
Well, I would say that it's actually editors make those decisions.
Yeah, okay, sure.
No, editors make those decisions.
That's a fair point. But they're informed by, and in the digital universe we all live in, the audience is king or queen. And if less than 5,000 people don't want to read about, if only 5,000 people want to read about Manus, then...
But we can't just chase clicks, because as journalists, you've got to...
No, it's a whole...
There's also the educate.
There's a whole show on that.
Educate, inform, and entertain.
Can I just mention one other dynamic there, which is, and it's a bit of vicious cycle, but because I think there's this element in the media where once readers or clickers or whatever we want to call them...
Clickers, yeah. That's a whole new term.
Become attuned to a story, they're going to come back to it.
Absolutely.
And follow it. And so
habituation.
Yes, okay. Well put. So I think that's an issue with a story like the DRC.
So the DRC, if we started reporting it every day,
I mean, it's not irrelevant. It's the longest, most expensive UN peacekeeping mission in the world. So like this idea that the audience have that it's irrelevant is completely wrong. And it's at the forefront of issues like the illegal trade in minerals, which are causing these issues.
There's a great Australian angle to that DRC story, and that is that Australia is a mineral. It's got a lot of cobalt, and there's a couple of companies that are setting up trying to be this alternative source of cobalt to go into your iPhone. So there are ways of actually finding stories which will be more relevant to your, or you know, your readers might be more interested in, but also mentioning the DRC and the issues there.
Okay, all right. Journalists need to try a bit harder, is what you're saying.
Yeah, they should always be open to finding the angle.
Yeah, okay. Look, we're running out of time, so I did promise that we'd get to a certain person who is either seen as the Messiah, a very naughty boy, a traitor, a potential sex offender, you name it. Well, of course, I'm talking about Julian Assange, who is currently in a British prison. And as we heard this week, is facing about 17 breaches of the U.S. or charges related to the U.S. Espionage Act. And this is kind of, as the commentary is, and I'm sure the listeners know, this has been a radical new way of looking at the Espionage Act, because journalists, even there have been some attempts in the 1940s, but this is a very rare thing that that a journalist would be facing espionage charges. Up to now, Assange has been, been facing conspiracy charges in the U.S. because of his relationship with Chelsea Manning, the whistleblower. I guess the central question, two central questions about Assange always, is he a journalist, point one? And secondly, and more complex, I suppose, this Espionage Act, and, you know, he's obviously got to be extradited to the U.S. to face them if he ever is. Does that raise the stakes in terms of how we talk about WikiLeaks and Assange? We'll go around the table. Jonathan. Is he a journalist?
I don't think he's a journalist.
Okay. Oh, just hold that there. Jamie, is he a journalist?
It's a tricky one. Yeah. What is a journalist? Difficult to define. I would have great problems with the way he undertook, just publishing raw documents on the web. I don't think is journalism.
No. Okay. Well, hold that. Chrysanthi, is he a journalist?
If this was a tutorial, I would have turned the question around and said, why does that question matter?
Oh, okay, but it's not a tutorial, it's a radio show, so is he a journalist?
I don't think it matters. I think what he does matters.
Right, what he does.
Is public interest journalism.
Okay, well, we'll stick with you and go back around the table. The espionage, facing espionage charges, is it an attack on journalism then, put it that way?
Yes, yeah.
That Assange is facing espionage charges?
Yes, it is. Because
therefore he is a journalist in your view.
Well, it's an attack on journalism because we actually can't – it's a sliding slope which then goes down to attacking whistleblowers, right? Uh-huh. So you have to protect the whistleblower and the journalist protecting the whistleblower or the publisher. I mean, one of the things about why we're talking about public interest journalism is because we are in this age where everyone has the ability to be a self-publisher, right?
Doesn't make everyone a journalist, though, does it?
No, it doesn't. No, because there is an aspect of Well, like Jamie was saying, you know, just publishing things raw on the web is actually quite dangerous.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Okay. I think a journalist has to be more of a, also have role as a curator and a responsible role in how to present that information and make sure it can't do real harm against the public interest. So I think that's how I'd define journalism. However, okay. I do think this, you know, the problem with the US using the Espionage Act to go after Assange is that it could set a principle.
Yes.
That in the future, you could find yourself with a New York Times journalist, a Guardian journalist.
A Financial Times journalist?
Yes. Any of those people, they could try and use the same act. This hasn't happened in 102 years of this act.
Indeed.
So it's very, you know, it's a dangerous principle to go down. And they could have used other legislative tools to try and prosecute Assange. Yes. So I think the Obama administration looked at using the Espionage Act, didn't do it because it felt that it wouldn't get through the Supreme Court challenge system. Mm-hmm. Now, Trump's put a few people on the Supreme Court. So I suppose the danger is that if the Supreme Court did allow this to go ahead, that it could undermine the First Amendment rights.
You know, indeed, and that's so kind that's of potentially Trump's game plan here. Jonathan, what do you think about the Espionage? And this is possibly the last word of the show.
Well, I agree exactly with Jamie.
You can't just agree. not for the last word.
I think I think that there should be potential consequences for, you know, highly irresponsible, dangerous forms of publication. But I don't think that the Espionage Act is the correct mechanism, and I think it has worrying consequences for, you know, more broadly for journalism, even putting aside that we're not necessarily classifying
a special issue of your journal, your magazine, to look at these sorts of issues? Because there's a lot going on about freedom of media.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fascinated, as you know, by the consequences also of you know, the whole fake news phenomenon. But issues that we're seeing in terms of the media and in terms of more broadly different forms of publication and the freedom of access that people have to kind of publishing globally are having huge consequences on politics around the world. And I think we'll definitely take a look at that.
And on the ability of journalists to do their job. On that rather somber note, we're going to leave this edition of The Fourth Estate. We have been talking to Jamie Smith from the Australian Pacific correspondent for the Financial Times. Thank you, Jamie.
Thanks a million.
Jonathan Perlman, the editor of Australian Foreign Affairs. Do buy it in a good bookshop and the world editor of the Saturday paper, which you can also buy in good bookshops.
Thanks, Peter.
And Chrysanthi Yotis, who is a postdoc research fellow at the Center for Media Transition and has some fantastic thoughts about how we can improve foreign reporting. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's been wonderful to have you all here. I think it's the sort of subject we could keep talking about, and maybe we'll return to it later in the year. But for now, thank you for listening to The Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. And make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favorite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics, and a few things in between at your leisure. And we'll be back next week with more. But in the meantime, stay in touch with us on Twitter, where our handle is Fourth Estate AU. My name is Peter Frey, and I'd like to thank my producer, Julia Carr-Katzel, and Anthony Dockrell. Thanks very much for listening. Bye.